From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Private security guards and public accountability. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Blackwater USA, with more than $1 billion in federal contracts, was on the carpet today on Capitol Hill. Congressional investigators claim that Blackwater guards shot first and killed innocent Iraqis in incidents the State Department helped cover up. Blackwater says the shooting was always defensive, that 30 of its men have been killed, and that none of the VIPs under guard has ever been lost. On To the Point, are they skilled professionals who free up Marines and soldiers, or rogue mercenaries who interfere with America's goals in Iraq? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the latest on Israel's midnight raid in Syria. First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. On Capitol Hill today, Blackwater USA got a grilling about its private security guards. On To the Point, are they highly paid mercenaries out of control or skilled professionals taking on the riskiest of necessary assignments? On Reporter's Notebook, both countries confirmed today that Israeli planes attacked a target deep inside Syria 3 weeks ago. But plenty of mystery remains. First, this news update. For the second time in the past 50 years, the leaders of North and South Korea met today in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-il was subdued, but South Korea's Roh Moo-hyun waved to cheering crowds in North Korea's capital city. Don Oberdorfer is a former diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. He's now chair of the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University. And Don Oberdorfer, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren. Glad to be here.
How important is this meeting? So far, apparently, they only met for 12 minutes, this in a very public way, with this odd difference in the way that they behaved.
Well, this is a three-day meeting, so it's just a greeting that is all we've had up until now. It's important. The first North-South summit that took place in the year 2000 was very important in sort of easing the way between the two halves of divided Korea, and that has had implications right up until today. This one is not as important as the first. The first is always seemingly much more important than what comes after. But it is an important continuation of the relationship, which is growing, between South Korea and North Korea.
The first meeting led ultimately to a Nobel Peace Prize for the president of South Korea. The current president, however, is facing an election very soon, and his party is in deep trouble.
Well, that's right. And he doesn't have much longer to be in office either. The election is in December, and he leaves office in February. So the South Korean president can't be expected to accomplish much as a result of this summit, except the symbolic nature of it to assure the Korean people and the world outside that the two countries are getting along okay and that they are moving toward a better relationship.
Isn't it likely that a South Korean president will be elected who is not as much in favor of rapprochement with the North as the current president is?
Well, you never know about South Korean politics. Anybody who predicts who's going to win the election at this point is probably way out ahead of where he should be. But the current favorite is from the more conservative party in South Korea. However, I've talked to him, Lee Myung-bok, the leading expectable next president, and he's going to be a little less enthusiastic, but he's in favor of improving relations with North Korea, very much so. The whole population of South Korea, with some very few exceptions, wants to move ahead. So I don't think that the change is going to mean turning back. It's just might mean, as you suggest, moving ahead at a slightly slower pace.
Of course, a reunification might actually be a huge problem for the South, might it not? Because the people in the North are so badly off, it might be a situation where they would effectively have to take over and care for and help millions of people.
Well, that's true. I think what you'll find after you talk to Koreans a bit is that many in Korea want to be unified, but not so soon.
Mm-hmm.
They want it to take place in stages. They realize that, as you point out, this would be a huge, huge economic problem. It would make what happened in Germany when Germany was united look much simpler than the situation that would take place in Korea.
What does it appear that this meeting today has to do with the nuclear issue with North Korea?
Well, it didn't have a lot to do with it because it had already been announced that before the end of this year, which is not that far off, the United States had worked out with North Korea a plan for what is called disabling their nuclear operations. It's not quite the same as taking them all apart, but making them so that they cannot operate for the time being, which is a step toward eventual dismantlement. So by the U.S. moving ahead in this way, it's not that it took the nuclear issue totally off. The two leaders are expected to talk about it, but there isn't nearly as much to talk about since the United States government is moving ahead rather rapidly, I would say, with North Korea on the nuclear issue.
A lot of skeptics, of course, including many within the administration and those recently out of it, such as John Bolton, about whether or not the North Koreans will make good on that promise.
Well, you know, it never pays to be extremely confident about what the North Koreans are going to do, but so far they have made good on what they've said. It's quite possible for them to make good on their promises, and I think that's very likely that they will, with the United States making good on its promise, which, among other things, means taking off some laws that impede commerce involving North Korea.
Okay. Well, Don Oberdorfer, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to do it.
Chair of the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University. In a moment, Blackwater USA, private security guards, and public accountability on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To The Point. America's major newspapers led today with charges against Blackwater USA, the private security firm that guards American diplomats in Iraq. Congressional investigators say Blackwater fired first in almost 200 shootouts, often failed to help injured civilians, and that many killings were covered up by State Department officials. Today, the House Oversight Committee began hearings. Committee Chair Henry Waxman, Democrat of Los Angeles, raised these issues.
Is Blackwater, a private military contractor, helping or hurting our efforts in Iraq? Is the government doing enough to hold Blackwater accountable for alleged misconduct? And what are the costs to the federal taxpayers?
Blackwater reportedly has federal contracts worth more than $1 billion. Company founder Eric Prince is a former Navy SEAL who has rarely been heard from in public. Today, he told the committee that shootouts occur when Blackwater guards are forced to defend themselves.
Most of the attacks we get in Iraq are complex, meaning it's not just one bad thing, it's a host of bad things. Car bomb followed by small arms attack, RPGs followed by sniper fire. An incident occurs typically when our men fear for their life. They're not able to extract themselves from the situation. They have to use sufficient defensive fire to get off the X, to get off that place where the bad guys have tried to kill Americans that day.
Again, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater USA, and the Americans he's talking about, of course, are high-level diplomats and other VIPs. Their job is to guard them. Warren Strobel has been following the Blackwater story for the McClatchy newspapers. And, Warren, thanks a lot for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Did the committee members give Mr. Prince, or are they giving Mr. Prince, a hard time?
Yeah, I would say they are giving him a pretty hard time, particularly on the Democratic side of the committee. Mr. Prince, all the cameras and all the eyes were on him because, as you said in the lead-in there, he has not been in the public eye very much. I'd have to say he held his own, didn't give a lot of ground, and vigorously defended his company's operations and contracts.
In the papers this morning, including your paper, there was detailed reports of this memo put out by the staff of Mr. Waxman's committee with a lot of charges against Blackwater and based apparently on a lot of documentation. What were some of the toughest ones that the Democrats brought up today when they were questioning Mr. Prince?
I think one of the most, the toughest thing was an incident. First of all, I should tell you and your listeners, Warren, that they were not allowed to talk about the most recent incident, the September 16th incident of this year, in which Blackwater employees allegedly killed as many as 11 Iraqi civilians. The reason for that is because the FBI announced yesterday it was launching an investigation and sent a letter to the committee saying, please don't discuss this in public because it's under criminal investigation. So a lot of the questions had to do with another incident that happened on Christmas Eve of last year when a drunken employee of Blackwater shot and killed a guard to Iraq's vice president. He was subsequently whisked out of the country within 36 hours, and a payment was made. And there were a lot of really tough questions to Mr. Prince about where the accountability was, why this person wasn't prosecuted, and the effect that kind of thing has on the view of Americans and the American mission in Iraq.
I understand what you said about the FBI and granting its wish not to talk publicly about that incident. Yet, Mr. Prince had already prepared testimony, which he released, did he not? Was there much information in there?
There was not a lot that expanded upon that incident, no. And, you know, the whole question of, this is an assumption perhaps, but one does have to ask whether the FBI announced an investigation yesterday in order to make sure that the this particular issue was not talked about in public today.
Okay, obviously a lot of politics going on here. What did Mr. Prince have to say about his employees, the Blackwater security guards, particularly in terms of the success of their mission of guarding American VIPs, and secondly, in terms of the number of his employees who'd been killed?
Well, that was actually one of his strongest points that he attempted to make, and with a lot of help from the Republican minority, who sort of feels like this whole hearing is a little bit of a witch hunt, Mr. Prince made the point that no State Department official or ambassador or U.S. civilian under protection of Blackwater has been killed in the, I guess it's a little over 2 years that Blackwater has been conducting these protective security details. But that sort of led to a question on the part of the Democratic congressman. Well, that may be true. You may be doing your job well in terms of meeting the terms of the contract, but what you're doing, the way you're doing it, is actually hurting the counterinsurgency mission that General Petraeus is trying to carry out in Iraq, and that is obviously to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people.
And again, Prince said that 30 of his people had been killed, I gather. Were those all, in his estimation, in situations where they were attacked first rather than shooting first?
Yes, he was over and over again saying, Warren, that, you know, they do not shoot first. They have what he described as a continuum of violence. I'm sorry, you know, sort of continuum of offensive response. Where, first of all, if they're in a convoy and in a car that is approaching them is looks suspicious, they wave and flash lights and throw water bottles at it and then flares, and only in the last instance do they use force. But, you know, I talked after the hearing with the mother of one of the four Blackwater employees who was killed in Fallujah in 2004.
Those were the men dragged through the streets and hung on the bridge.
Yes, yes. And she said, you know, take what Mr. Prince said, divide it in half, and divide it in half again, and that much is truth. She just felt like he danced around the questions, and she was happy the hearing was held, but she and the other families are suing Blackwater, and she certainly felt that Mr. Prince was not given the whole truth here.
So he's getting it from both sides, or many sides, I guess.
Yeah, and also, to be fair, a lot of the fireworks here were not between the committee members and Mr. Prince, but between the Republican and Democratic sides of the committee, as you might imagine. Many of the Republicans were basically accusing the Democrats of launching this witch hunt against a company that is is seen as a Republican-leaning company because of Mr. Prince's family members.
And his family members are big-time contributors to Republican causes and candidates, is that right?
Yes, his sister is a woman named Betty DeVos, who is a former chairman, I believe, of the Republican Party of Michigan, and also a pioneer, in quotes there, for President Bush's campaign, which means that she's donated a large sum of money. The Democrats are saying, no, this is an important issue here of accountability and cost and private, you know, the whole issue of privatization of military functions. This is not a partisan hearing.
Again, Warren Strobel is senior correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. He's been covering this story for a long time, and we'll cover the rest of the hearing today as well. It's not over yet. A moment ago, we heard Congressman Waxman ask, is this private military contractor helping or hurting our efforts in Iraq? Major General Robert Scales is retired from the Army. He's former commandant of the War College. He's now president of the defense consulting firm Colgan Corporation. General, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, it's good to be back. Thank you.
We heard a moment ago that there has been criticism. We've heard it on former programs here that the counterinsurgency mission of the military is being damaged by private security guards and particularly by Blackwater. What do you think?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, I'll tell you one thing. My friends in the theater for a long time now have been very, very nervous about Blackwater because they, you know, Dave Petraeus does in fact have a counterinsurgency plan. The purpose of that is to instill confidence in the Iraqi people of our presence in Iraq, and many people in the U.S. command are constantly looking over their shoulders about what's going to happen next with Blackwater, particularly since Blackwater spends a lot of its time and most of its and many of its missions are actually in Baghdad, which of course is the politically most sensitive part of this counterinsurgency campaign that Petraeus is putting together.
So when you say that they're looking over their shoulder, what are they looking over their shoulder for? What are they worried about?
Well, I mean, if there's a sense among guys in the military that these guys don't have a lot of control, that the incidents that they participate in leaves a bad taste in the mouths of many Iraqis. And to the Iraqi on the street, he sees an American vehicle whiz by and it's a bunch of guys shooting out of it. He doesn't know whether that's an Army unit or a Marine unit or a contractor. And so, you know, the sense is that that a lot of the a lot of the anger that these types of incidents gin up, whether inflated or not, tend to fall back, unfortunately, on the poor soldiers and Marines who oftentimes have to come behind these incidents and mop up.
Warren Strobel, back to you with McClatchy Newspapers. One of the allegations made in the documentation released by the committee last night was that the State Department hasn't done anything to supervise or hold accountable the Blackwater Guards. Did that come up today?
It did only in passing, but you know, Warren, that's going to come up in the afternoon session, which will be starting very shortly with the State Department. Three State Department people are going to testify. The documentation, as far as we've seen it, seems to indicate that no, they haven't. Not only have they not provided oversight and accountability, they've actually helped Blackwater, I don't want to say cover up, but to sort of play down these incidents, pay off the families of people who were killed and move on.
Back to General Scales, what's your take about this as far as the State Department's role in all of this is concerned? Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen in the rest of the hearing.
Well, I mean, there's some history here, Warren. Remember now, the State Department started off down this road in 1994 in the Balkans, where they had an opportunity to develop their own internal security, but instead they chose all the way back then to start contracting out, and that was 13 years ago. So they have a very comfortable relationship, if you will, at contracting out security. And now I think that's all sort of coming home to roost, because when you contract it out, you certainly lose control.
Warren Strobel, did the Republicans bring that up, that it was during the Clinton administration that this whole situation began?
Yeah, they did. One or two of them did, and they sort of, you know, asked Mr. Prince, when did you first get your first contract? And lo and behold, it was in 1998 under the Clinton administration. It actually happened after the explosion aboard the USS Cole, or sorry, the attack on the USS Cole, that he got some training contracts and so forth. So, yeah, they did attempt to make that point.
Again, Warren Strobel's with McClatchy Newspapers covering this hearing. We may lose him in a couple of minutes. And Major General Robert Scales is retired, a former commandant of the Army War College, now with Colgan Corporation. Stephen Schooner is co-director of the Government Procurement Law Program at the George Washington University Law School. He was formerly with the Associate Administrator for Procurement Law and Legislation at the Office of Federal Procurement Policy and the Office of Management and Budget. Stephen Schooner, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
What are the advantages to either party, either administration, having private security guards as opposed to having the kind of work that Blackwater does performed by soldiers and Marines?
Well, I guess just to start out, I don't necessarily want to speak in favor of the privatization of the use of force. I mean, I think that it's a perfectly reasonable position for the public to take, that the government should have the monopoly on the use of force. I think that the problem that we have in Iraq is that what we have is a rather ambitious agenda for the use of the military, and we have significant statutory constraints on the size of the military, and the bottom line is we don't have enough people in uniform to perform all of the tasks that need to be done. So we have some choices. We're not going to reinstitute a draft in this country in our lifetime. At least that's my perception. We don't plan to be leaving Iraq anytime. We don't plan to be scaling back somewhere else. So if your military isn't big enough to meet your needs, and if your allies aren't going to provide the troops you need to get the security that you need, you're going to have to go elsewhere. And unfortunately, I think that's what leads you to reliance on contractors.
What about the cold, hard facts of getting what you pay for? And when a president wants to conduct some kind of military action and knows he's going to be held accountable, what does the budget look like? What's the bottom line? What are the differences between private security guards and soldiers and Marines?
I don't think that there's any question that if you look at it in the short term, it looks incredibly expensive to rely on contractors. If you look at the daily rate or the annual rate of an arms-bearing contractor, much higher than a soldier or someone in uniform. The far more complicated factor, though, if this is in fact a short-term reliance, it's incredibly expensive to recruit and train and maintain and then deal with a soldier in retirement. And one other example that we don't talk about very much, let's just assume you have a contractor standing next to a soldier and both of them have a leg blown off by an IED. The minute they leave the country after they've had their ambulatory care, the government washes its hands of the contractor completely. The bottom line is the soldier, for perfectly good reason, will be entitled to medical care, physical therapy, rehabilitation, literally for life at that point. But it's in fact, much cheaper to have these, in effect, disposable contractors. And we haven't even gotten to contractor fatalities, but we may need to talk about that as well.
Very quickly, Warren Strobel, back to you. Do you expect at the hearing that the congressman will be asking questions like that, getting to, once again, the question raised by Congressman Matt Waxman initially of whether the contract is helping or hurting our efforts and whether it's worth what it costs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were sort of three lines of questioning today. One was accountability. Are these people accountable and to whom? Second, are the mission, are they hurting the mission or helping it? And third is the question of cost. And there are a lot of numbers thrown around today. Eric Prince was trying to make the point that, yes, in one level it is cheaper to have a contractor do it. It looks like it's cheaper to have a military soldier do it, but in fact, you have all these carrying costs that go along with that, and in fact, it's cheaper to do it by contractor over the long run.
All right. Warren Strobel, going back to the hearing, senior correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers.
Thanks
a lot for being with us. We'll be back with General Scales, Stephen Schooner. We'll also talk with Robert Young Pelton, who has written a book called License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. On Reporter's Notebook, Israel and Syria acknowledge that strike, but don't say much more. We'll talk about that on To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking today about Blackwater USA, the private security firm with $1 billion in contracts to guard State Department officials and other VIPs in Iraq, being grilled on Capitol Hill today by Democrats, particularly in a House committee on accountability of the private security guards, on whether they interfere with the mission and what they ultimately cost the United States as compared to what it might cost to have soldiers or Marines conducting similar functions. Robert Young Pelton spent 3 years living and traveling with security contractors while researching his book, Licensed to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. Good to have you back on our program.
My pleasure.
Earlier we heard from General Scales that military officers are looking over their shoulder, concerned that Blackwater guards might come into their area where they're trying to deal with counterinsurgency and effectively disrupt the missions. How do ordinary soldiers feel about Blackwater and the other security guards?
Well, there's two levels. One is you got the enlisted guy who sort of looks at these guys as rock stars, you know, with all their gear and their shiny SUVs. And then there's the commanders who go, oh, God, not another incident I have to clear up. The most flagrant example of that was when I think it was Thomas Hams was running the Fallujah area for the Marines, had a Hearts and Mind program in place, and then when the four contractors took a wrong turn and were murdered, you know, our policy shifted to sort of flatten Fallujah, and then that's an example of how these guys slide our foreign policy sideways.
What again, though, the question of the younger soldiers or the enlisted soldiers, thinking about these guys as rock stars, explain that, and do they all hope that once they get out of the Army, they can become the same kind of people?
Well, you got to remember, most people that work for Blackwater and other security companies are not officer level. They're mostly, you know, enlisted men. And this is kind of the most money they're ever going to make in their life. So if you're a, what we call private snuffy, and you're getting out of the military, your employment options are limited. So if you take the class at Blackwater or any other academies that teach people how to be PSD or private security detail operators, you know, making between $400 to $600 a day is pretty darn good money considering your skill levels.
As opposed to what does a soldier get?
Well, the joke is that, you know, 20 years as a special forces soldier in the Army gets you an ex-wife, a Harley, and a job at Walmart as a greeter. People who are trained in sort of high velocity or high kinetic skills like shooting, blowing things up, really have a hard time getting a job when they get out of the military. So this is really where it's at.
Robert Young Pelton, Major General Robert Scales, again, back to you now with the Colgin Corporation. Does that make sense to you that enlisted people look at this a lot differently than the officers do?
Well, there's no question about it. In fact, you know, you asked the question about how much these guys make. I mean, a private in the infantry makes about $22,000 a year, and some of these guys make well into six figures. And if you do a comparative analysis of who has the more dangerous and certainly the more uncomfortable mission, it's the young infantryman. And, oh, by the way, it's also important to know that a lot of leaders for these security firms are themselves, as your previous guest just said, guys who sort of just recently come out of the trenches. And so when you get up to the colonel and general level who look around and try to shape public perceptions, try to build an effective counterinsurgency campaign, have a long-term strategy of how to deal with the population in Iraq, to have these guys running around the neighborhood is certainly unsettling.
Do you agree with Stephen Schooner that the reason we have private security guards is that the military simply isn't big enough to do all of the things that are being asked of it?
No, absolutely. No question about it. Remember, job one in Iraq isn't electricity or water. It's security. If you don't have security, then we don't have a policy in Iraq. And the people who do security are the same people who were asking to do the counterinsurgency mission, to do cultural contact with the civilians, and to fight the close battle. You can take every one of these soldiers and Marines in the entire U.S. military and put them inside of FedEx Stadium. I mean, there's only like about 85,000 of them in the whole military who are trained from the ground up to do these type of persistent security tasks. And so, you know, and this is when I was a general years ago, the Army had 16 divisions. Then it went down to 14, then to 12, then to 10. And it had not been for 9/11, we would have gone down to 8. You cannot do boots on the ground missions with the forces we have. So you're right. Two choices: give up security in Iraq, or find some way to add it using some other way.
Robert Young Pelton, let me go back to you. When you were researching your book and hanging out with some of the people that we were talking about, what was their attitude toward what they do? You said this may be the most money they ever make in their lives, that they'll do better than they did as soldiers. But how do they regard the civilians, for example? There's so much of that in this memo put out by the Democratic committee staff yesterday, that they're unfeeling, unconcerned, kill people and drive on by, don't stop to help the wounded, and that sort of thing.
Well, you have to remember, there's two major thoughts in any contractor's mind that's obviously keeping his client alive, or whatever he's guarding, could be a truck full of gravel, and also keeping him alive or his team alive. And you have to remember, this is not the mission of the U.S. In other words, when a contractor heads out in the morning, he's not supporting sort of our bigger goals in Iraq. He just has to get from point A to point B as quickly and as efficiently as possible. What I found, I did the airport run every day for a month in sort of late 04, which was sort of the hot spot. And
that's from Baghdad to the airport, to one of the most dangerous places in Iraq.
Yeah, that's the one I asked for, and that's the one I got. Yeah. And the bottom line is that everybody looks at you. They flip you the finger. They make explosion motions with their hands. They drive too close, and they're baiting you, and they're watching you, and they're testing you. And when the car bombs do hit, it's usually a sort of a white sedan that just seems to be driving a little too close, and all of a sudden, whoomp, here it comes. So you can imagine with that kind of stress and that kind of attitude every single day that when you are given a choice and you have the ability to fire a weapon to either deter that person or neutralize them, you will always err on the side of violence. And that's what I noticed over and over again when I was with Blackwater.
Err on the side of violence. Stephen Schooner, back to you with George Washington University Law School, formerly with the Office of Management and Budget. You said that you think that unless we have a draft or drastically reduce the kinds of missions that we have around the world, this is situation is going to go on for a long time. What sort of oversight, then, would be appropriate if it's not being exercised today?
Well, there's so many different directions that could go, but at a minimum, it would be nice if the United States military and more broadly the United States government actually had a plan for appropriate uses or when to employ private military. One of the most frustrating things about what we see in Iraq right now is Blackwater is merely an anecdote. It's an example. I mean, the Iraqis may resent them more than others, but they're not even a significant percentage of the arms-bearing contractors we have on the ground. The State Department uses Blackwater to guard diplomats. The military uses arms-bearing contractors to defend the Green Zone, among other things. And then the largest cadre of arms-bearing contractors on the ground, or private military, are contractors who are defending other contractors supporting various missions for the United States government in Iraq. So you have this massive disaggregated group of people, not all of whom are American, not all of whom work for American companies, and since the first day we've been in Iraq, the United States government has not appropriately staffed the contract management function. So in effect, too many of these people are unsupervised, and the one thing that everybody learned in kindergarten is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and all we're talking about at this point is cure.
Are they costing us then more, according to your own experience in the Office of Federal Procurement Policy and the Office of Management and Budget, than they're worth?
Well, I think that's an incredibly complicated question. I mean, if you were to ask somebody at the State Department, how much is it worth to keep the ambassador alive? The military tells you, we don't have anybody to protect the ambassador. Very hard for me to put a price tag on this. At the end of the day, this is the best value calculation made by the State Department, and of all the people criticizing Blackwater right now, for better or for worse, one of those voices is not the State Department.
Robert Young Pelton, what are the or how would you describe some of these other arms-bearing contractors besides Blackwater, the ones that defend the Green Zone, the ones that defend the other contractors in order to keep them in business? Do they all behave the same way?
Well, there's about, according to the official numbers from the security organization in Iraq, there's about 70,000 security contractors. Half of those are Iraqis. And then if you divide that 35,000 number in half again, you get what they call TCNs. And those are people from El Salvador, Nepal, Uganda. They do things like check your car to see if it has bombs in it. Or when you go into the embassy, for example, you have to go past these smiling Gurkhas who stand there with a gun. If you want to eat at the chow hall, if you want to go to any kind of office, you have to speak Spanish to the guys from El Salvador. These are sort of third world or second world troops that are told to sit in one spot. They do static, is what it's called. And then you have your PSDs. These are the guys that move around, the thing that Blackwater's famous for. And these are the guys that weave through traffic at 70 miles an hour with their SUVs and scare the bejesus out of the locals. And then you have just smaller and larger permutations of that, which are called security. You could have people running, a friend of mine's making $225,000 a year running a UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle out of Tikrit. So you have that kind of security apparatus in place. So they're everywhere.
General Scales, back to you. You were commandant of the Army War College. You spent your career in the military, although obviously you're now in the private sector and in a high-ranking job. But how does this sound to you as an officer, somebody from the Army who devoted his life the way you did to protecting the United States?
Well, I think we're just reaping the whirlwind, Warren. I mean, we have, from a national security standpoint, dedicated ourselves to a to treating war as a science project. Somehow war can be won with machines. And the enemy has a vote, just as your other contributors have just said. And the enemy said, if we're going to beat these guys, we can't beat them plane on plane. We're going to take them on the ground. And so we woke up after 9/11 with too few soldiers chasing too many missions. And all of those missions relate in one way or another to security. And so everybody now, not just in this country, but in other countries as well, are scrambling around trying to find a way to fix these problems. And I understand it. I know where it came from. But I think it's time that we all stood back and breathed into a bag for a moment and found out, hey, we're going to fix this over the long term. Are we going to continue to hire contractors? Well, if we are, we better find better rules and regulations, you know, to control them. If we think that this ought to be a government issue in providing security, then we're going to have to increase the size of the Army and the Marine Corps.
I should say that the Associated Press has been reporting that the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, is saying the Pentagon is going to improve its oversight of private security firms in Iraq. General, is that an appropriate task for the military rather than the State Department? Should they be in charge of the private contractor?
The short answer is absolutely yes. At the end of the day, if you want to have something done on the ground in Iraq or in Afghanistan, you have to call on the guys who do this for a living. You can't turn to a foreign service officer in the State Department and ask him or her to start come up with a security plan. That's not what they do. This is what the military does. It's late in the game, but somebody, I think, had better really jump on this. Otherwise, this whole thing is going to spiral out of control.
Stephen Schooner, you used the phrase earlier, monopoly on force, and thought perhaps that it ought to be the military's. What about now the turf war that one might envision between the Pentagon and the State Department over the private contractors?
I think it's a hugely complex issue, and I was actually surprised that General Scales a moment ago didn't mention the fact that as a military commander in the battle area, it has to be a concern that you have literally tens of thousands of people, arguably allies, walking around in the battle area bearing weapons who don't report directly to the military commander. We have problems with command and control, obviously problems with communication. We obviously have language barriers. I believe that Mr. Pelton mentioned that just a few moments ago. But one of the most remarkable things about Gates' statement the other day was the suggestion that the military might, in effect, exert force over State Department contractors. That is exactly what we do not want to be using U.S. resources to do. We've got enough problems over there, but to have any kind of tension or let alone force exercised between the United States military and U.S. contractors is a frightening proposition.
Well, who's going to do it?
Well, the question is what we should be doing. At the end of the day, the State Department should be managing its contract to whatever metrics, to whatever rules of engagement, whatever goals and outcomes it's trying to achieve. And if, in fact, the State Department wants to be part of winning the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, it is fully capable of modulating Blackwater's behavior. And this is true for all the contractors. But at a certain point, you get what you pay for, and the contractors perform to the contract. That's the difference between people in uniform working for a military commander and a contractor who has a bargain providing services for money to the government. The State Department has dominion and control over that contract, and they can make the contract work the way they want it to. Remember, however, the State Department seems very, very happy with Blackwater's performance.
So, General Scales, you're out there, you're a military person, you tell the contractor to do something, he says, wait a minute, it's not in the contract.
That's exactly right, and that's the problem. And, by the way, in most cases, the military can't get close enough to the contractor to even ask the question. That's really the issue. I mean, a commander in Baghdad is given a ward or a sector, and he is given authority for everything that happens in that sector for providing security, except the management of contractors. And finally, I'd probably disagree with my colleague in one sense, that if Mr. Gates woke up one morning and said, I will from now on provide security for the State Department in the combat zone, much as the U.S. military does now for security of embassies, I feel pretty confident that the State Department would oblige. The problem is we just don't have the people to do it.
Quickly, General, if you can, we're running short of time, but you talked about war as a science project and trying to operate with fewer people rather than more, something that was associated, of course, with the former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and yet this whole whole private contractor setup began under the Clinton administration. Do you think that there's a political aspect to this that you can with contractors, or it appeared this way anyway, you could conduct military activities without being held accountable for it?
No, this is not politics. This is culture, Warren. The trend towards war as a science project, towards this technocentric approach to war, goes back to the end of World War II. This has been at least four or five administrations, beginning with Eisenhower's strategy in the 1950s to replace manpower with firepower. We're just now beginning to reap the whirlwind.
Robert Young Pelton, when you talk to the contractors, military contractors, does it appear that they're looking forward to a long time of being able to make a lot of money doing this kind of work?
Well, you have to remember, when you step back from this whole thing, and you remember the words of General Shinseki when he was asked how many people it would take to make Iraq happen, and he said 400,000. Well, you've got 180,000 contractors. You've got 160,000 troops. That's almost that number. And the fact that we've outsourced because we don't have military capability is becoming a larger and larger part of our foreign policy. And just one quick thing. The fact that the State Department runs around Baghdad with Blackwater is also part of our forward-leaning foreign policy, where we do business where people don't want us. And we have to think that that's a sea change in how we do business around the world.
Okay, interesting thought. Very probably a subject for another program. Thanks to you all, Robert Young Pelton. The book, Licensed to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. Stephen Schooner at George Washington University Law School, formerly with the Office of Management and Budget. Major General Robert Scales, retired, former commander of the Army War College, now president of Colgin Corporation, defense consultant. And our earlier guest, Warren Strobel, has gone back to the hearing for the McClatchy newspapers. Thanks very much to all of you for being with us today. Both Israel and Syria officially conceded today what everyone already knew. In a midnight raid last month, Israeli planes struck deep inside Syrian territory. But what were they after? And what did they hit? More on a mission still shrouded in secrecy in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Today, Syrian President Bashar Assad confirmed last month there was an attack. When he did that, Israel then lifted its total news blackout, and Israeli papers reported, there had been an attack. But that's all they can say. Gordon Litchfield's correspondent for The Economist magazine in Jerusalem, and Gideon Litchfield, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, good evening. What
do we know today that we didn't know yesterday?
Practically nothing. As you say, the Israelis have lifted censorship on the fact that there was an attack. They haven't lifted censorship on any of the details. I think the main reason they lifted it was, as you say, Bashar al-Assad officially confirmed it from the Syrian side, and things had gotten to the point here where the Israeli journalists were simply making fun of the censorship because they weren't allowed to say there had been an attack, so they had to keep on in their reports saying the attack that, according to foreign news reports, Israel carried out on Syria. So I think, you know, the government just decided to remove the most ridiculous element of the censorship. But other than that, nothing has really changed.
Now, President Assad, though, said all they hit was an empty building.
Yes, and the Israelis, I think, are very content to let the mystery continue about what was actually hit. What we've seen over the days since the attack happened has been a series of rumors in the foreign press, which have virtually all been sourced to Washington, about the idea that there may have been cooperation between North Korea and Syria, that there may have been a nuclear facility, or maybe that there were arms being passed from Iran or Syria to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they were hitting an arms shipment. All of that stuff has been allowed, all that speculation has been allowed to circulate. The Israelis have kept their mouths shut, and I think it seems to me as if it's in their interest to allow the mystery to continue, either because they actually didn't hit anything important and want to leave the possibility that they might have done on everyone's minds, or because maybe they want to leave some room for backroom diplomatic maneuvering, which would be lost if they actually went out and said what they'd found.
Have these rumors that you referred to been reported at all in the Israeli press, even attributed to the foreign press?
Yes, in the sense of attribution to the foreign press, pretty much everything has come out here.
Uh-huh.
But it's all in this kind of roundabout way.
Now, you said that most of these reports were sourced to somebody in Washington, D.C. What's the implication of that?
You know, again, all of this is speculation. There's absolutely nothing that anyone can say for sure. One of the theories that has been very popular among commentators and on blogs and so on is that there are people in Washington, particularly in Washington, and maybe also in the Israeli hierarchy, but particularly in Washington, who are interested, who have been trying to demonstrate a link between North Korea, Syria, and Iran for years. They may be people who are unhappy with the talks going on now, the six-party talks with North Korea, and so they've been very eager for anything that might demonstrate that North Korea was involved in supplying nuclear material to other states. And it may have been that Israel found something that looked to it like plausible evidence that there was something afoot in Syria. It decided to launch a raid on the strength of that. It may have gotten something inconclusive, but according to the theories, nonetheless, the fact that the Israelis are keeping silent about it is being used by people in Washington as an excuse or as a way to put out these rumors about the North Korean link into the public space, into the information space. And so, yes.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you used the word plausible. Is it even plausible to suggest that the Israelis conducted this raid in order to create all this mystery without really having any firm intelligence about any of these possibilities, nuclear assistance from North Korea or arms for Hezbollah or whatever?
That, to be honest, I find implausible. Okay. I think that the Israelis would not have carried out a raid like this, which they knew carried a big risk of a Syrian military response, and indeed they were carrying out maneuvers for months in advance, preparing for the possibility of a Syrian retaliation. So I don't think they would have carried out a raid like this that carried a risk like that unless they really had good reason to. What intelligence exactly they had that led them to suspect that there was a nuclear facility or some other important weapons facility there, I don't know. I mean, there's been stuff reported in the foreign press about in the international press about Israeli satellite images, which were maybe shown to certain people in Washington. But whether any of that, what was in there, what it suggested, what conclusions they drew, is still up in the air, and it just may stay like that for some time.
Again, we're talking with Gideon Litchfield, who is Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist magazine. Well, has Syria threatened any kind of response?
No. Up to now, it has been saying that it will respond at a time of its own choosing. And indeed, it's been very interesting, the fact that Syria has itself kept relatively quiet about everything that's been going on and has chosen not to retaliate. And lots of people are interpreting that as a sign that Israel really did hit something that was very embarrassing for Syria. But again, there are various interpretations you could put on it. So I think what seems to be clear is that the danger of an immediate war breaking out between Israel and Syria has receded, and maybe thanks partly to the heavy Israeli censorship. But where it goes from here, I don't know. Anyone's guess.
Well, how effective is this censorship if the Israeli press can say the foreign press is saying blah da blah and simply tell the story?
Because those are the rules under which the censorship works. The censorship is incredibly broad in the sense of reporting actions of the Israeli army, basically anything that the Israeli or foreign journalists like myself based here report about the Israeli army in theory has to pass through the military censor first. In practice, that rule is used with a lot of leeway. But in this case, they really did clamp down and told the Israeli press, don't print anything related to this. But when something is reported in the foreign press, the censor, there is no censorship rule saying that you can't report that the foreign press said so. But it carries a lot more weight because it doesn't come from the Israeli source.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, supposedly everybody knows, do they not, that the censorship exists and that this is a way of getting around it?
Yes. I mean, it becomes, when a particular, everyone knows that censorship exists, when a particular event is censored, the fact that it's censored is also censored. But when, you know, and this is part of the reason I think why they started to lift the veil a little bit, is that after a little while, when the foreign press is reporting things and the Israeli press is not, it becomes patently clear to everybody that censorship is operating.
And you said they were kind of making fun of it today. Are you and other foreign correspondents subject to censorship in Israel?
Yes, again, in theory. In theory, anything that I write about an Israeli military action anywhere should go to the military censor before it's published. As I said, that's interpreted with a lot of leeway. So for the most part, they don't bother to apply that rule, but they apply it much more strictly to Israeli journalists who have much closer military sources who may be reporting stuff that could indeed be sensitive.
Have you been visited by military censors or asked to submit material in this particular instance?
No, I haven't.
Could they?
Not that I would be allowed to tell you if I had.
Okay. all right, because, of course, censorship is censored.
Exactly.
But they could clamp down on you, presumably, if they chose to do so.
They could.
And
yes.
What would the consequences potentially be?
I mean, it could be losing my press accreditation, you know, losing a journalist's visa, that kind of thing.
In the meantime, how soon do you think we'll find out what really happened in this raid?
To be honest, I'm not sure that we will find out. I think, as I said, that there is a certain interest on Israel's part in keeping things mysterious, which may, you know, as I said, to some people, that suggests that they actually didn't find anything worth reporting, because if they had, they'd be trumpeting it to the sky. But it may also suggest that they, you know, did hit something that does embarrass Syria, but that they're keeping it quiet in order to give some kind of leeway for negotiations or have something, you know, with which to pull Syria on. And, you know, there are issues that could be coming up in the future that they would want to use that leverage for, whether it's this November peace summit that is supposed to happen between Israel and the Palestinians, whether it's something for America to use on Syria over its involvement in Lebanon. So it may be that this issue just remains in the background.
Gideon Litchfield with The Economist in Jerusalem. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Vanessa Romo with Carolyn Radziner and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To The Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast, as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.